Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. For Republican politicians, is being on the Trump team the golden ticket to electoral victory? Let's get to the bottom line. Across the United States, the power of former President Donald Trump has grown in the Republican Party. In August, his hand-picked nominees in the party's primary elections were able to displace long-standing politicians like Liz Cheney in Arizona. His candidates have not won everywhere, but there are still a lot of them. Now comes the hard part. Can they win the people's vote in a couple of months? And what are the chances that the Republicans can flip control of Congress? That's one side of the coin. The other side is the Democrats, who are deeply divided between moderates and strident progressives. So if both sides have their own radicals to deal with, how can they ever find a happy middle ground for the sake of all Americans? Today we're talking with Congressman Rodney Davis, who has represented Illinois in the House of Representatives for the past 10 years, and who has just lost his seat to Congresswoman Mary Miller, who was Donald Trump's choice in the Republican primary. Congressman Davis, thank you so much for pulling over on the side of the road. I know you're driving to Iowa from Illinois. Look, I want to have a very thoughtful discussion on what's happening in American politics right now, and really both parties, where it seems stridency seems to be the way to victory. And I'd just love to get your sense of things.
Well, stridency depends upon the district. Look, I represented a district and won a district 10 years ago that was drawn to elect Democrats. And I beat Democrats every single election cycle in the general election. I beat back primary challenges at the same time. But my district I currently represent was much different than the district Democrats drew my house into in this race. And therefore, I was much more subject to the stridency, much more subject to an endorsement from the former president against me.
Now, Congresswoman Mary Miller was also an incumbent. So this was an incumbent in Congress versus an incumbent. And I guess my question is, you know, we saw this also in New York, where we saw Jerry Nadler and Carolyn Maloney put together on the Democrat side. So somebody's going to come out winning. But I'd just be interested in your side. Where does the value of being, you know, someone who can deliver on what your constituents want? I know constituents may not always know what they want, but what is the chemistry? Has it changed in 10 years? Does deal making, is that bad? Is getting nothing done good?
Well, listen, in my case, I was completely overrun in the last weekend with a high turnout in areas where President Trump came in to rally for my opponent. And we didn't have as high a turnout in the areas that we did very well in. And that's also due to the fact that Illinoisans have never voted in a June primary. I wouldn't use my race as a barometer of what works and what doesn't. We had the resources, we had the messaging, and frankly, up until Election Day, we had the polling and the data to show we were going to win. But things can change, and I give the president and his team credit for making that happen. But in the end, common sense governing, I don't think, has gone by the wayside. I think most members of Congress who are going to be successful, as I have been in areas where they've known me the most over the last 10 years, that people want government to get things done. They don't want Washington to be the only level of government that dysfunction is expected rather than scorned upon.
You had one of the most interesting committee assignments that I know of. And folks, I'm going to tell you, I'm really into wonky stuff. I'm into detail, and I like to know how things run. And Rodney Davis was responsible, the ranking Republican, for the House Administration Committee that really ran things and also poked holes in things like the security of the Capitol in January 6th and raising a lot of questions. And I know you've been out there in a constructive way saying for years now that we have problems, that we're not administering and running the system as well as we could. I'd love to give our audience an understanding, particularly as we saw January 6th rollout. Why haven't we been able to plug in some of the holes that you've been talking about for a long time?
Because, frankly, everyone's focused on the January 6th Select Committee. Remember, I was an original appointee to that Select Committee. I spoke with Speaker Pelosi when we reconvened on January 6th about doing a bipartisan commission, a commission that I think President Trump would much rather have than what we see with the Select Committee right now. But as time went on, I don't think Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats were serious about a true bipartisan investigation. If they were, they would have allowed our House Administration Committee to do what the Senate Rules Committee, our counterpart in the Senate, did. They did a bipartisan investigation. They released findings months ago. We could have done that in the House, but it wasn't the narrative that Speaker Pelosi wanted. And here's my biggest fear, Steve. You know, I introduced the Capitol Police Transparency Act long before January 6th. We have a broken system in and around the Capitol complex because of the way the decision-making matrix exists with the Capitol Police Board. And unfortunately, a lot of those security-related questions are not being asked by the Democrats or the two Republicans on the January 6th Select Committee. It's an utter disappointment. It's an utter failure. And it's something that I know my successor will get questions answered when we take over the majority in January.
If you had remained a member of that committee and done this, what would be some of the key questions and issues you would have raised that aren't being raised now?
Number one, why was the security posture so bad leading up to and on January 6th? Remember, because of my position as the ranking member of House Administration, I was given a security briefing by the assistant chief of the Capitol Police. There was nothing in that briefing that led me to believe I would witness what I saw on January 6th. Now, because of the bipartisan investigation the Senate did months ago, we now know that intelligence was forwarded from the Norfolk, Virginia FBI office to the Capitol Police Intelligence Division that the Capitol would be under attack. I've confirmed, not only through the Senate bipartisan investigation, but by talking to him directly, then Police Chief Steve Sund was not even made aware of that intelligence. Why are the questions not being asked about why that one intelligence failure happened, let alone the many others? Why did we have glass that was able to be broken on the outside of the Capitol building? These are things that have to be addressed in a very thoughtful, bipartisan way. But instead, we're stuck in this vortex of the Select Committee focusing on one person and one person only, and that's the former president.
Now, is there a way, and I ask this carefully, to both have gone down the track that you think is so important on security and intelligence, who knew what, when, and why the adequate parties weren't notified, but also to look at the fact of what I think we know is that Donald Trump, President Trump, also knew what he was doing, also knew a lot of those folks were armed and didn't care about it, said they weren't after him, and wanted, in any case, as we've seen some reports, allegedly, to lead in part, you know, the storming of the Capitol. Is it possible, and should we have had a kind of committee that dealt with all elements of that equation?
Listen, the key word in your question is allegedly. Remember, the Senate Rules Committee did a bipartisan investigation that focused a great deal on the security failures in and around the Capitol complex. The bipartisan commission bill that I wrote in January that every single Republican voted for as part of a procedural previous question vote would have been the best chance for us to get all questions answered. Keep in mind, there's always a lot of hyperbole and discussion and interest in anything the former president does, because frankly, he lives rent-free in the minds of most in the media and in the minds of every Democrat that I know. But in the end, why in the world did our brave men and women who saved me and my friends on a baseball field 5 years ago, why did those brave men and women in the Capitol Police, why were they ever put in the situation they were? Why didn't they have the equipment that they needed? Because it was locked on a bus that no one had the key for. Why didn't we prepare, even when the president asked his advisors and his military leaders to prepare for a large number of people that could be violent? Why weren't those questions asked right now in the Select Committee? And why aren't we getting answers? Those are the answers that the American people deserve right now, Steve.
I just want our audience to know that the incident that Congressman Davis is referring to was an attacker who came in and attacked the Republican members of a baseball team. Congressman Steve Scalise was nearly killed in that incident. You had others that really showed incredible heroism in that moment. So this was a moment of political violence in this country that I think is important to remember. But let me ask you a question. You know, you more than many other members of Congress have taught me about many of the values and the issues that are going on in agricultural America. The district you represent is a lot of farmland. You're very, very popular with the Illinois Farm Bureau, et cetera. We're endorsed by them. I'm interested in the questions of what is in the mind of voters right now, what you think, because we're seeing some interesting results in some of these earlier races in Kansas. Perhaps it was the reversal of the Roe v. Wade abortion decision, maybe others. Democrats are beginning to think that they have a chance to survive the midterm elections. Where do you think things are going to go in November? What's your gut tell you in terms of at least what your part of the country is feeling?
Yeah, I tried to convince myself that we would keep the majority in 2018 also, Steve. The winds aren't there. I mean, every single little movement towards the Democrat or every single tick up in the president's approval rating gives the Democrats hope. And those who hope that they stay in control, it gives them hope. It gives them that look ahead. But look at 2020. 2020, Democrats were expected. And on Election Day, Speaker Pelosi and then DCCC Chair Sherry Bustos boldly predicted a gain of Democratic seats in the range of 15 to 25, including mine. But we ended up winning by almost 10 points. And, oh, by the way, we Republicans picked up a net of 15 seats. So keep in mind the generic ballot now is better than it was in 2020. Everybody wants to point to Kansas. Hey, that's great. Will the Roe v. Wade decision increase Democratic turnout? Absolutely it will. But will it also energize some low propensity Republican voters who, like me, care about the life issue? Absolutely it will. But if you delve down into that Kansas amendment, remember, look at the messaging those who were opposed to the amendment used. They used an anti-government message that it was government coming to take something away from the citizens. That played well, even for pro-lifers who voted against that, or who voted against that amendment.
Rodney, is there a way to be a successful Republican in Congress today or to get elected and to be independent of Donald Trump? Or is being a Trump Republican pretty much part of the deal?
Again, it depends on the district. Look, I got to give President Trump and his team credit. He came in the weekend before the election and completely changed the turnout model in a low turnout environment in a primary in June that had never been held in June before in my lifetime in my home state. So things happen that way. I got to give them credit for strategizing and executing that strategy extremely well. But if you're going to have a barometer of somebody's loyalty to any one individual, I just think that's short-sighted. It depends on the district. Look at the Republican conference I'm a part of. It's made up of a whole host of good Republicans who govern. And they're winning. They're winning districts that they weren't supposed to win. And we're going to get more of those governing Republicans when we eviscerate a lot of moderate Democrats that are going to fall prey to the wave that's coming in November of this year.
Look, I know that this is a hypothetical, and I'm hoping after the next election you're going to be out in Washington to hang out with as we both talk about these issues. But what is revenge going to look like in the House? What do you think is on, you know, whether it's Kevin McCarthy or Steve Scalise or other potential future speakers if the Republicans do win the House of Representatives? Is revenge going to be high on their roster, or is delivering to the American people and getting things done going to be high on their roster?
Well, that's going to depend upon who's discussing what is considered revenge and what is considered just living up to the promises that we made. So will Republicans get rid of proxy voting? I believe they will. Some may call that revenge against the speaker, right? And against Democrats who have stayed at home rather than come in and do the job that I think we're asked by our constituents to do. We're going to get rid of the metal detectors that are lined up outside the House chamber. Is that revenge? Or is that living up to the promise that we made the day they were put up? So we're going to make decisions that have been long planned out before we take the majority. And I've been a part of those planning decisions. And a lot of those executions of those decisions are going to be called revenge. They're going to be called something nefarious by the Democrats and those who sympathize with the Democrats in the media. So beware. because we've laid out what we intend to do. And that should not be a surprise to anyone once Kevin McCarthy is Speaker of the House.
Look, I want our audience to know that you are a conservative Republican. We've known each other for many years. And, you know, as a conservative Republican who has issues you care about, you nonetheless have a lot of insights into progressive Democrats who sit across the aisle. And I should say that Congressman Rodney Davis is one of those who has very often worked across the aisle to move legislation forward, you know, to come to compromises on various issues. But I'm also interested in the divides on the Democratic side. We've just seen Senator Joe Manchin eventually kind of hold the line, move a $3.5 trillion deal down to basically nearly half a billion. But basically, you have huge divides in the Democratic Party as well. And we should be careful of this. But, you know, a lot of people know Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, as she's known in the world, is sort of seen as the head of one wing of that group. You've got folks like Joe Manchin that many Democrats can't even believe he's a Democrat and are upset about it. But I guess the issue for me is, from your perspective, what are you seeing from your perch happening in the Democratic Party? Are they going over a cliff from your perspective? What does the stridency on their side look like?
Well, it's going to be a party that's going to be more, the majority of their party in Congress after this next election will be more hardcore progressive Democrats. I mean, look, that's what happened with us as Republicans after many of the more governing Republicans got eviscerated in the 2018 election cycle. That's just the natural ebb and flow of what happens. Why, Steve? Because most competitive seats are represented by governing Republicans or governing Democrats. That's just the nature of the electorate. Why? Because they represent their constituency, who actually rewards them for governing, like in my district that I've represented for 10 years. They like the fact that I'm considered one of the most bipartisan Republicans in this Congress, and have been, as I promised to be, my entire career. But when you look ahead, the key is going to be, how is the next 2 years covered? Because when it comes to the folks like you and the media and others, you have to look at what's realistic and what's not. Think about this. Let's say we take the House. I still believe Mitch McConnell will be the leader of the Senate. It'll be a slim majority, I think so. But Joe Biden's going to be in the White House. Do you really think we're going to have major legislative packages that are going to come through in a bipartisan way? No. I would even say hell no. What we're going to see is oversight, oversight, oversight. And that is going to bring to the forefront those who are responsible for the oversight in the respective House and the Senate. And those committees, and I, a lot of my good friends on that committee, and my really good friend Janie Comer is going to be a great chairman of oversight in the House. Jim Jordan, a friend, is going to be chair of judiciary. They are going to be the faces of that oversight. And that's where a lot of hard far-right members on our side, the Freedom Caucus folks, and the hard-right members in the Senate, and the hard-left members, the progressives, the Democrats, they are going to be the ones dominating the airwaves, because the next 2 years is going to be oversight, oversight, oversight.
Fascinating perspective. Let me ask you a question as somebody who follows administration so well. We saw, whether we like it or not, just to be candid, things like the counting of electoral, the certification of electoral votes. Who knew that that could be a controversial issue? It was sort of a routine, you know, ceremony. But it be it. And now we're all trying to learn about all the different classifications of secret documents. And what are the powers of the president, which turn out to be pretty vaguely defined, that the president can declassify when he wants, but it's unclear. You are a very, very astute person about process, administration, and rules. How much out there, and I, you know, talking about the Mar-a-Lago documents and the fight and tussle between the National Archives and President Trump, how many of these holes do we need to fill and get away from ceremony and habit and actually need to begin to look at what could go wrong, if not just with President Trump, but that other future presidents just take advantage of opportunities out there nobody had thought about before?
Well, come on. I mean, it's amazing to me. We've had former high-ranking Democrat national security officials stuff classified documents into their suit coat and then it's brushed aside. You know, democracy is not under attack when Democrats steal classified information, right? But all of a sudden, there's an unprecedented raid on the former president's home. I mean, he lives in Mar-a-Lago. Look, I'm not happy that he came out and made sure that I didn't win. But also, you got to take a step back and ask yourself, would that have happened under any other former president? I don't know. We'll have to see what the evidence is put forth by law enforcement officials. But we shouldn't have an attack on law enforcement by Democrats or by Republicans. But keep in mind, you mentioned the election certification. I remember in 2017 sitting on the House floor watching my colleagues who are dominating the airwaves talking about how rejecting certification of electors is a threat to democracy. They were trying to do that themselves. And think back to 2004 when we actually had a vote to decertify Ohio's electoral votes for President George W. Bush. A few current committee chairmen voted to decertify. Now, was that democracy under attack? Did we begin to look at changing the process, which I think personally should be looked at? But in the end, my colleagues who voted to decertify election results are not the first, and it shouldn't be a partisan issue. That's a vote that they made on behalf of their constituents. I made a different one. I voted to certify those electoral results, just like many of my Democratic colleagues voted to certify President Trump's electoral results and President George W. Bush's in 2004. We have to make sure that we don't put a red shirt or a blue shirt on decisions that have been made by the other party years ago. Otherwise, it creates this confusion. It creates an environment where it's nothing but polarization, Steve.
Well, you know, one of the things I was really grateful to you, you know, doing this show today and coming in is I like our audience to know that all of America is not Brooklyn, New York, that there are many other parts of the country. You are in Illinois, 50 miles away from the Iowa border, I think driving to Iowa. I would just love our, and people don't see everything the same way. Just show us where you are. Pick up the camera and show our audience a little bit of rural Illinois that you're proud of.
You know, I'm actually in Wood Hole, Illinois right now, Steve. It's in Henry County. And as a matter of fact, I'm from Des Moines, Iowa. So when my mom and dad used to drive us back home to see our relatives, we would always stop here at the Wood Hole Plaza. So I'm here, and I tried to get this as my backdrop earlier, but the sun didn't cooperate. Look at that corn.
Wow.
You want to see good corn? That's Illinois corn. I was in California this past week, and their corn does not look like this corn. But come out here to the Midwest. Come join us. Randy Feenstra, Marionette Miller-Meeks, Vicki Hartzler, and G.T. Thompson and me come out to the Farm Progress Show in Boone County, Iowa this week.
Well, I will have to end it there. But Republican Congressman Rodney Davis of Illinois, really appreciate you pulling over on the road. And thank you so much for talking with us. And look forward to seeing you in Washington soon.
Absolutely. Take care, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? Let's dispel a myth. Donald Trump is not all powerful. He lost the presidency. Of course, he's still really influential, and his brand still helps some, but it hurts others. But let's get beyond Trump. What's happening in both parties today is something far more worrisome. Stridency is on the rise. The desire to listen to one another, negotiate, make a deal, is fading away. Today's American politics is about never giving up, never surrendering your own views, pounding on the table, no compromise. Is that the recipe for getting elected today? So getting things done, bad. Not getting things done and being ideologically outrageous and unyielding, good. Well, the outcome of these politics is going to be messy. And what a lousy model for the world. And that's the bottom line.